Pauline, would you tell us about the health and medical care services which were available in your childhood, particularly when you were a young girl in the home?
Yes, we had a doctor who who lived in New York, but who commuted to Pleasantville 5 days a week, and who gave the children all of their care. Occasionally, a child became very ill and had to go to a hospital. There was a hospital on the grounds. We had a trained day nurse and a trained night nurse. My health personally was good, and most of us ate well, ate too much, of course. We slept well, we breathed fresh air, and there was very little illness as far as I can recall among the children or among our own family.
Suppose you tell us about your adolescent years.
The fun and recreation that we had could not be duplicated today because television has preempted any kind of personal creativeness. We grew up in a home where there was a great deal of music. I mentioned to you that my sister played the piano, but I sang, both my other sister and I sang. And my father had a trained voice. He used to sing with me particularly, and used to really upset me because when he liked a nice high note, which he could hit, he held on to it for 2 pages, and I was back on the next page. He loved Schubert and Schumann and all of the old German composers, and to this day I have volumes that are falling apart that are marked for take a breath here and so forth. But we did have a lot of fun with that. And then my sisters, who were older than I and who were being courted at the time that I'm referring to during my adolescence, had their boyfriends who used to come and visit us. And there was one family, Evelyn, my oldest sister, married the oldest member of the family, and he became a teacher in Pleasantville. He had a series of brothers of all ages, and he always brought his brothers along. And we had a big open house, of course, so that we always had the Crone family for weekends. Ted was my sister Marie's boyfriend simply because he was the next in line. And I inherited Ted when my sister finally found someone of her own. So we had lots of fun and lots of singing, and we gathered around the piano, and that was our entertainment. And my brother and I used to play the Victrola. They were hand-wound Victrolas in those days. In order to catch the words of the operatic arias we had, we would slow it down. And the slower you made it, the deeper it got, so that Galli-Curci could sound like an alto. But we learned the words to all of the operatic arias. And of course, to this day, we love opera.
And how about your recreation during your high school years? Was that primarily music too?
To a great extent, except that living in New York, where you could go to the theaters for 50 cents and sit up in the second balcony, we never missed a Saturday afternoon matinee. And in those days, of course, the Broadway was flourishing. So we had a lot of fun and managed to see a great deal of what was going on. We danced. But mainly it was in the musical field that we had most of our enjoyment.
Did you ever go to the shore?
Oh, yes. We went to, of course, living in New York. You weren't too far from the shore. During a few years prior to the time we came to Pleasantville, my father had a serious illness, and we took a place in Atlantic City for the summer, and that was my first experience with the seashore, which we loved. And I always, when I go to New York today, want to go, if it's even only to Coney Island, to smell the ocean, because I miss it.
I think it's time to start talking about your courtship.
Yeah. Well, that's a very pleasant period of my life, of course. When I came to Pittsburgh, I had my 20th birthday in Pittsburgh. And at that time, as I told you, I was working for my father in the Federation office. I met a young man whom my father knew from New York, who later became my husband. His brother and my father were colleagues. They were both in social work. His name was Abraham Ozeroff, and my husband's name was Israel Ozeroff. My father met him on the street one day and said, "Oh, I'm glad to see you. Why don't you drop over and meet my family?" And so my husband came, and he met his family. I was busily engaged in the kitchen with an iron, pressing a dress, and I came out and said, "How do you do?" and went back into the kitchen. And pretty
soon... Excuse me, may I interrupt for a minute? Yes. I'm a little confused about Abraham and Israel.
Israel's my husband.
Abraham
was a social worker in New York, and he was a colleague of my father's.
Related to your husband's?
Yes, brother.
Brother. I see. I wasn't clear.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
But that was how I met my husband. Mm-hmm. He looked the same. Well, he came into the kitchen, and my mother came in, and she said, "We have company." And so I went into the living room, and pretty soon he started to invite me out. And we went out for several months. He was a very shy man. He was 10 years older than I am. He had already been to college. He had been in the war, World War I. He was then in business with his father. They were in the pants manufacturing business. And I guess he realized that there was quite a difference in our ages because between 20 and 30, there's a big difference. It's not like the difference that exists today. Mm-hmm. He seemed very interested in me. I was interested in another man at the time and was really very, very much interested in him, but he was 16 years older than I was. And my family was really very upset that I even paid any attention to him, but he had a twinkle in his eye, and he was an attorney, had gone to Harvard, and he was very glamorous, much, much more glamorous than my husband to me at the time. And it took a little bit of doing on Iz's part until I realized that he was the one. We were engaged in March. We were married in May. We are now married 53 years.
How long was your courtship?
About 3 months.
3 months. Is that all?
That's
all. Well, he really convinced you quickly.
He convinced me. There's a long story about that, but I don't think I need to go into detail.
Did you have a big wedding?
Oh, yes. We had a big wedding. Dr. Bernstein was the head of the Federation, and he had lots of board members who needed to be invited, and the staff in the Federation building was invited. I personally didn't have too many friends because I hadn't been in Pittsburgh too long. But we were very friendly with the Robin family. Leo was a composer of music. Do you remember Leo Robin?
Yes, I knew Ruth Robin.
Ruth, yeah, well, Ruth.
The younger sister.
Yes.
She was a dramatic.
Yes, yes. Well, Ruth was the youngest of the six.
She was adorable.
She was darling, and we were very friendly with the Robin family, with Nate and with Leo and with Bertie and with Irma and with Rosalie and with Ruthie. And that was the family. And, in fact, Bertie was my bridesmaid, and my sisters were other attendants. We had the wedding on the top floor of the William Penn Hotel, and it was rather formal. Dr. Goldenson was our rabbi at Temple, because my family had joined the Rote of Scholem as soon as they came to Pittsburgh. And from there on, of course, we took up the kind of marriage that you take up when you're young and starry-eyed and so forth.
May I interrupt? I don't think we asked you particularly about the religious atmosphere of your childhood.
Yes, I think I did mention to you that I was very interested in Hebrew. And in the orphanage, I went to services every week. To this day, I know every word of the Union Prayer Book in Hebrew by heart because of the many, many years of hearing it over and over again. I studied Hebrew with a man by the name of Maximum. We used to call him Minimum. He was an advocate of a method that they then used called the Benderly Method. And you recall I told you that you held something up and you said, Mazeh, and then, yes, what is it? And then you told what it was. Well, I did prepare to be able to teach Hebrew. But as time went on, nothing ever happened. I loved it. I'm a very religiously oriented person, more so than the other members of my siblings, rather. My brother is interested in Judaism, I think, in a way, mostly from the intellectual approach. My father, who had not been schooled in Hebrew, studied it and conducted the services in the orphanage.
What type of, was it Orthodox or?
No. It was a, in Pleasantville, because the children came from all backgrounds, it was a compromise conservative. And we did have seders in our home, and we did have a sukkah built outside, so we did observe the festivals. And we still in our home today have a seder, and still do many of the things, not because my children particularly have shown any great interest, but Iz has and I have. And so we are very Jewish-oriented, and most of my life has been in a Jewish community, so I never knew what anti-Semitism was, and I never knew some of the things that make people resentful of being Jews, because they can't cope with it.
You had a good foundation.
Yes, we did. That's the reason I went into detail. I felt that it was a little different.
Fine. Now...
You were Reformed.
Yes. Always. I found that Iz had joined Road of Sholem when he got out of college. So that when the Road of Sholem had this 50-year celebration a couple of years ago, we were included as the 50-year members.
All right, now if you can come back to the wedding, actually.
I think where they lived after a newlywed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we lived in an apartment for the first year of our marriage. And then we bought a home, and it's the home in which we live today. So we've been in that home for 50 years. Slightly more than 50 years.
On Northumberland.
And the neighborhood really hasn't changed in that length of time. It's amazing that it's still a good, respectable, well-tended residential neighborhood.
Have you seen changes in it in any sense, politically or economically or culturally?
Not too much. And this is amazing to me. The little street that we border on, which is Severn Street, seems to have many of the faculty who work at Pitt.
Olive Squirrel Hill, does this seem...
Oh, it has changed.
Well, Linden School now has the black element thing by school,
yes.
Which is the school your children attended.
Oh, yes. And I think when our children went to school, there were very few Jewish children in their classes. It was not a Jewish neighborhood primarily at the time, but I think that Miss Patterson, who was the principal of Linden School, became well known for her modern methods and for her strict discipline. And Miss Patterson said that the children who came to her school were overindulged and overprivileged, and she sort of cut them down to size.
Good to hear that about non-Jewish children.
Yeah. Yes, well, the neighborhood is not today even primarily Jewish, although I think our street has quite a number of Jewish families. We still have a number of people who go very solemnly to church every Sunday morning. And you know they're going to church because they wear hats. Mm-hmm. And we've always been very friendly with our neighbors, the Jewish as well as the non-Jewish, although it's never been one of these run-in and visit
But 50 years ago when you moved there as a young woman, you still felt no anti-Semitism.
No. We had a Jewish family.
You were no longer in a protected atmosphere. Like the
orphan. Oh, no. But you see, I lived in New York for a year when my father was at the Bureau of Philanthropic Research. And we lived in, I would say it must have been a Jewish neighborhood then. It was on Washington Heights, 181st Street, and Riverside Drive. There were many Jews in New York. I don't think that the average person, unless they have to buck the world, gets to feel the anti-Semitism.
And not even on Northumberland Street 50 years ago?
No. If it existed, I didn't know. Well, wait, excuse me. There was a family who lived next door to us very briefly by the name of Lapay. They are today not in such happy circumstances, but they were society at that time. And Mrs. Lapay had a little daughter, a teenage daughter, and she didn't like us very much. And when we sat on the porch, she would bang her blind down. They moved away shortly after that. We had very dear neighbors next door, upstairs, there's a duplex next door by the name of McGowan. And incidentally, Dwight McGowan, I just saw in the paper 2 days ago, Dwight died. They were Christian scientists. The boys were a little older than our boys. They were very friendly. Mrs. McGowan and her husband and we were very friendly. And while she did try to proselytize us, she realized very soon that we were pretty staunch in our own feelings, and then there was no further effort for that. But they were lovely people. And there really wasn't, as I know, any definite anti-Semitism. If there were feelings, they were very well concealed. There was a Mary McKenna who still sends us New Jewish New Year cards and whom we still send Christmas cards. She has moved away since.
But your children in school, weren't there huge Christmas celebrations?
Yes, I think they took it in stride.
We all did.
Yes,
we didn't know any better.
No, we never had a Christmas tree and we never had anything of that sort. But the children knew that this is a holiday, and they had Christmas vacation, and it was great. And I don't think it bothered them very much. If it did, I didn't know it.
It bothered them.
It bothered them, yes.
Because
I can look back. Yes.
And I didn't say it to my mother and father either, but your feelings of inadequacy were beyond description.
At the time of celebrations.
And with the gifts that the little neighbors were getting.
Yes. Well, when I went to elementary school and they would talk about Christmas, I would wonder about it. But
that wasn't a Squirrel Hill Christmas.
No. No, well, of course not. But I never said anything about it because I thought, well, we're different. We're Jews. And that was it. I don't know, maybe our feeling of was secure enough.
You might have been sustained at home with many other
Yes, but I don't ever remember coming home and saying, why don't we have a Christmas tree such as all the other children have?
Because we didn't dare say that.
No. Well, I don't think I even thought it.
I felt very excluded.
You're very much younger than I am, and it's And I think that as time came went on, things were different.
Possibly more commercialized and more obvious, possibly, than in your day. It may not have been the big extravagance that it became.
That's true. Now they start celebrating Christmas right after Halloween. They don't wait for Thanksgiving. It used to be Thanksgiving.
But when they sang carols in school, didn't you feel left out?
Well, I felt that they were singing something we didn't believe in. The question that you asked or were about to ask about occupations covers a gamut of many, many years, and I made a note of some of the occupations so that I wouldn't leave anything out that would be of interest. But it will cross over, I don't know whether you'll even be able to read these notes.
Will you give us some idea of the occupations you've had throughout your long life of working?
Yes, I would love to, because I've had two jobs in my adult life that have been very meaningful to me. When I retired as president of the Council of Jewish Women, I was really at loose ends, and having been interested in interracial work, became involved in Camp Achievement, and which was a Negro interracial camp, actually, and the George Washington Carver movement. And it was at a luncheon for George Washington Carver Day that Mr. Aaron Levinson, who was then president of the Levinson Steel Company, talked to me about a foundation that they were establishing, which had been working for about 6 months then, but which had no real guidance. He asked if I'd be interested. It sounded like a great idea. I knew nothing about foundations except from having applied to the Pittsburgh Foundation for help for the Council of Jewish Women at the time that the Council Lounge was opened. But I knew Mr. Belfer, who was the executive director, and when I told him about this job, he was interested as head of the Pittsburgh Foundation. And I spent several sessions with him during which he gave me the guidelines and told me how to go about doing this so that the proper amount of attention would be given to those agencies which deserved it, how to go about finding those that were not worthy. And I went down to the Levinson Steel Company and I worked there for 9.5 years.
Were you director?
I was the director of the foundation. I am still on the foundation board, and I serve as a volunteer secretary to the foundation board.
Will you now tell us about your years as council with National Council of Jewish Women?
Yes, I would love to do that. I became interested in the Council of Jewish Women, not through council, but through the Y. I was interested in the Y and belonged to the Y Choral and belonged to the Y Music Society, and certain people who were interested in both discovered that I could do certain things and gradually got me involved in council. But they didn't bother to have people come up to me and say, "How do you do?" And when I used to go to council meetings, I sat alone.
That is very typical.
I didn't know anybody. These very people who said, "You ought to be the secretary of the Council of Jewish Women, because I have watched you do this, and I know that you can do it well," never took the trouble to come over and say, "This is Pauline Ozeroff, and she is new to our organization." Frieda Reisenstein picked me up. I'm sure you remember Frieda, do you not? Well, Frieda was one of the biggest workers in the council and in the Y. And in
Florence?
Florence's sister-in-law, but another generation. I sat at council meetings for several years without anybody ever saying hello to me. But I went, and then one fine day I was asked if I would be secretary of the Council of Jewish Women, recording secretary. I said, yes, I would. And that is the way I got into the council. I got on the board with actually nothing except a few little jobs that Lola Schoenfield, as president, had asked me to do. Lola knew me. She spotted me, and she heard about someone said they knew me. But it really was a very cold organization, extremely cold.
Do you think it's changed?
Yes. Of course, I would say it has changed now, because I have a little different
perspective,
and because I have achieved a certain amount of
recognition
because I earned it, not because I had the social status which many of the people had then, but because I showed that I could do things. I was asked to be chairman of the Toyery when it was organized. I was always organizing.
Of the what?
The Toyery. We had a little place on Fraser Street, which was on the edge of Oakland, where you smelled the pollution from the mills. Only we didn't know it was called pollution, and we just felt sick when we were there. We had toys, and every Saturday morning, the neighborhood children would come in, and they had a library card, our library card, and they would borrow a toy for a week. And we had skates and tricycles and dolls and books and anything that the council members would donate. And Frieda Reisenstein's sister-in-law was Mrs. Alexander Silverman. Did you know her?
That name is very familiar.
She never had children. She would be very touched by my report. Oh, by that time, they would listen when I got up and talked, because it was something that they felt was of interest. And when I would tell her that we were broken into every night and things were stolen, she would always dig into her purse and give me a $5 bill to buy two or three pairs of skates. And it was that kind of
thing. Did you buy new toys in addition to the donated toys?
We bought new toys. We started out with, I think, we had a $100 budget or something of the sort. The Toyery functioned quite a number of years. And
during what years? Can you place it?
Yes, before I became president of the council, the junior council, in fact, had a co-interest in it, and it was a senior and junior co-project. These girls used to come down and staff it on a Saturday morning. That was the one day that they gave out the toys. And then during the week, I would go down, and my co-chairman, whom I don't even remember now, and Lola Schoenfield, who was then president, and we dusted the shelves, and we kept the toys in order, and we kept them in repair. This was a good project. You don't even know it today. Well, you see, this must have been, I became president in 1949. This must have been probably, my father was still in Pittsburgh then, so it was in the 30s. It was in the middle 30s, I would say, about 1935 or so, because he left in 1937. I remember taking him there. I was very proud of it. There were other projects that I did for council, but where I really got into it was when I became secretary. After recording secretary, I was corresponding secretary. And we had a few presidents who weren't too adequate, and one in particular who used to lean over to me and say, "What do I do next?" Somehow or other, I don't know how I knew, but I seemed to know, or at least she got away with it. The only office that I never held in the council outside of presidency and vice presidency was in the fiscal line. I have a real blind spot when it comes to money. I think it was because we were always overindulged and I never knew the value of it. We were overindulged at home. I never was a financial secretary. I was never treasurer, fortunately for the organization. I was never auditor. But I held every other elective office in the council from 1949 from the fourth vice president up to the first. And I was vice president when there were no designated 1, 2, 3, 4. I believe that's the way it is now, isn't it?
Departments.
Departments, mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell me this, Mrs. Oshrock. How did you manage to budget as president if you had so little knowledge of fiscal affairs? That's a very important thing, the budgeting.
Well, you don't do it alone.
No.
Don't forget the council is a very democratic organization, or was when I was part of it. And we had a budget committee. We had some very knowledgeable people on that. We had Ada Berger, whom you must remember, who used to get angry when you talked about petty cash, and she used to say, there is no such thing as petty cash. Every nickel that you spend is spent for a purpose.
She was a watchdog.
Ada was a watchdog.
Yes, okay. You remember her. That was Mrs. Berger of the Gulf.
Yes. Yes. Ada B. Berger, B-U-E-R-G-E-R, and do not make a mistake.
Oh, the mother of...
mother-in-law.
Yes.
Ada loved me. She loved me because I was Dr. Bernstein's daughter and because I would listen to her. I admired her. She was so different from anything that I was. I admired her so much for the things that she knew. I studied parliamentary procedure with her, and I just sat at her feet. In fact, she installed me. Now, you want to know about the council presidency. That was a very, very exciting period in my life. I was not slated to be council president at all. I was slated to be president of the Conference of Jewish Women's Organizations. I had already accepted that. The conference was the overall picture of all the agencies. There must have been about 25 or 30 in at that time. And it was a group that met monthly or bi-monthly, and they had clearinghouse for dates so that you wouldn't conflict with each other. And you represented the Jewish women of the community at non-Jewish affairs. And by that time, I felt very secure in going to non-Jewish affairs and speaking for the Jewish women, because I was very proud of the Jewish women. And so were the other people, and a little envious, the non-Jewish agencies. The reason I became president was that the president-elect, who was Sarah Levant, suddenly had a serious illness in her family. Her husband was at death's door, and she was advised to pull out. A committee came to see me. I had been first vice president under Minnie Sussman, and Minnie had been pregnant at the time, so I was really conducting the board meetings and doing many things, and Minnie conducted many of them from her seat. But it didn't look right for her to be making the public appearance, and so there I was.
At that time, it didn't look right.
Oh, now you flaunt it. All right.
What year was that?
1949. Is when I became president. Her child was already a couple of years old. The committee who called on me knew that I had accepted the conference presidency, and the chairman of the committee was Rose Arnold, whom you know, Mrs. Sigmund Arnold, I'm sure you know her. And I said, what will I do? I'm committed. I would like to do this. This is something I would like to take hold of. I think I could do a job. She said, we know you can. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take the conference presidency if you will take the council presidency. And that was how it happened. And that was how I got to be elected president. I was fortunate to come in because I had my feet in the door and I knew what was going on. It was at the time that the National Council had sent out a directive that the core program was to be geriatrics, and that we were to organize some kind of a facility for older people. Now, I know some of the people who have been interviewed have said it was their idea, or it was their project. I know that. But actually, this was from the national headquarters that this came out. When I was vice president, National had even sent one of their workers out at a luncheon. We had a luncheon, of which I was chairman of the day, at the Shenley Hotel, and she talked about geriatrics. There's a new term, we didn't even know it. She explained to us it was just like pediatrics, only it was for older people. And we were told about the lounge in New York, which was already functioning at 100th Street and Broadway. And that was the start of the Council Lounge. Now, it was being organized all the time that I was a vice president, so that I was very well aware of all the steps that were being taken. And the night that the lounge opened was about 3 or 4 days after I had been installed.
Where did it open? Where was its location?
It was located in Forbes. A building on Forbes Street, 5846 Forbes Avenue. I'm pretty sure that's the number.
Second floor.
The second floor. And there was, above us was a dance studio. And
Genevieve Jones?
No, this was an Italian dance studio. I don't recall his name. But we got the whole floor. Minnie Sussman was very instrumental as president in getting Mrs. Anafin to give the first $5,000, which helped to not to staff it, but to buy some of the materials that we needed to go into business. We all donated bookcases, chairs, tables, a kitchen chair, a stool, whatever we had, and the furnishings were far from beautiful. They're nothing like Anafin House is today, but it was fine.
It was roomy.
It was roomy, it was spacious, and people couldn't get over it. And it was non-sectarian. And this had to be announced in the very beginning. We had a problem with making it known, and the fact that we were running a social agency without a social worker had a great deal, there was a great deal of conflict in the Jewish Federation, which existed for many, many years, and I'm happy to say has now finally been resolved, but it took many years. They objected to the fact that we were running a so-called social agency without a social worker.
But you had a very fine director.
Yes, we had a fine director.
Ethel Summerman.
Yes, but before that, it was agreed that in order to meet the objections of the community, number one, I was asked to go to a meeting at the, what we used to call the Ikes, the Squirrel Hill Irene Kaufman Center, and tell them about our program. And they said, well, they were planning, they had been planning when they opened to have a program for older people, but since we are already adequately covering it, they will leave this out of their plan, which they did not do. We were advised by the National Council. We were in constant touch with our national office. We were advised to set up a professional advisory committee that insisted of Mr. Passamanic, the director of the Y, Mr. Levine, who was the director of the Irene Kaufman Settlement, a man who was in charge of the Parks and Recreation, the Bureau of Parks and Recreation, his name...
Benstock?
No, it began with an R, and he had only one R, I remember. He's a very lovely man. We got in all of the people who we felt could be of help to us. Oh, and Mike Schwartz from the Jewish Federation. And we tried to cover all bases, and we tried to give them the feeling that we were cooperating in every way. They suggested that I call the Jewish Welfare Board and ask them for a geriatric director. I called Mr. Berlatsky, Mike Berlatsky, who was their, not their director, but their personnel director, whom I knew very well because of my contacts in the social work field in New York. And he said, you don't need a professional director. You need a woman with some educational background. She doesn't even have to be a college graduate if she has the right kind of background. The main thing she needs is to relate to people and to get along with people and make them feel welcome. If you have problems, you refer them to the family agency or to whatever agency they need to reach in order to have their problems worked out.
What sort of problems were they anticipating?
We didn't know. Some of them had financial problems, some of them had health problems, some of them had family problems. There was rejection in the families even then.
It was for that reason that
yes.
they felt a professional social worker
That's
was
right.
advisable.
Yes, but Berlatsky said this field is so new we don't have any. And don't worry about it. So we got Frieda Brownman at first, who was a school teacher and who was very good and who told us it would only be for the summer. She had other plans for the fall. And then we got Ethel. We had a few others for a few days here, a few days there, trying out. They felt it was very taxing, or they couldn't handle it, or it was depressing to be with old people, which was ridiculous because these were the healthy old people. They came up ready to dance. They came up ready to have fun. Then we got Ethel Summerman, and Ethel was with them until a couple of years ago when her health broke down and she had to leave. Ethel was great. She could sew. She could lead them in sewing. She could lead them in knitting. She could play the piano. She could teach them dancing.
And she related to them, really.